This is CliffCentral.com. Love,
love. I love her. She's Anne Marie, and the song is called 2002, which feels like a millennium away. Huh? Doesn't it feel weird when you think about 2002 and you think that's ages ago?
I was in grade one. No, in 2002.
Hold on, you were in grade one.
Oh, sorry. Never mind.
No, it's amazing how things are. Like I look back as a child, thinking in the year 2000, I'm going to be 29 years old. Oh my God, I'm going to be so old.
Yeah, past it.
And then you look at it's just incredible. And time flies. You don't feel like the age. You think to yourself, am I this age?
Yeah.
It's because your mind or you just feel like you're still 20, 21 or 22.
Mm.
It's amazing.
There's this story in the news and this clip that's been passed around about this South African woman in Hong Kong.
Are you going to play the clip?
Mm.
Oh, you got to play. But you know what? I've watched it 12 times, I think.
Well, you loved it that much?
I can't. I'm not like that. I'm not one of these people that goes over clips over and over again. Mm-hmm. But this woman, she's just gifted at entertainment.
So, all right.
Sure.
The story is, she says, I came from South Africa to move away from this. And talking about the Hong Kong protests. But it's all, it's very me. And look, a lot of people are saying, oh, South Africans are so embarrassing. I never, ever have taken responsibility for other South Africans being embarrassing, or for white people being embarrassing, or for men being stupid, or any of that stuff. I can only take responsibility for me. So that's a stupid way to think about the world. Like, in the minute anyone who looks like you...
Or sounds like you... Or says they're from the same place as you.
You must be responsible for them. I don't understand that at all. But here she is. Listen to this. Obviously, this is
it's
anti...
It's about 56 seconds long.
Yeah.
But it's 56 good seconds.
So obviously,
the weekend in Hong Kong ended in chaos.
Anti-government
protests here are now in their 10th week. Thousands of demonstrators turning out, clashed with police in smoke-filled scenes that seem to be set on repeat. And the violence is only getting worse. As night fell on Sunday, clashes spread across the territory.
You could have edited this part, eh?
Footage captured
on,
by local
on.
TV showed police
Sorry.
Chasing protesters.
It's giving people the background.
And it's, you know what, you're right.
And
Sorry.
Beating them as they tried to
Sorry,
escape.
Sorry, I'm rusty.
Meanwhile, across town, other media reported that a young protester had been hit in the eye with a beanbag round fired by police.
I mean, it's really hardcore in Hong Kong at the moment, and people don't understand how, you know, desperately... angry some of these people in Hong Kong are. They've lived in a certain open
bubble.
Society for a long time. Well, they've lived in a society that, compared to mainland China, is very open, where you're allowed free expression. There are all kinds of things that happen in Hong Kong that weren't happening in Beijing or in Guangzhou.
And now China wants it to be more like China, right?
Well, the real reason for all of this is that China now wants to be able to extradite people from Hong Kong into the mainland.
If you're naughty,
which means if they don't like what you're saying, because it's an authoritarian regime,
yeah,
they can just lock you up. So here's the South African woman, all right? Here she is. Just listen to her and see if this is annoying to you, like it is to so many people.
From South Africa to move away from this. Like, South Africa has this.
Come on, mate.
I don't want
Come
this.
On, mate.
This is not the Hong Kong that I've learned to love. Like, everybody is so, everybody in Hong Kong is so lovable and welcoming for all foreigners. And then to experience this, it hurts me. It really hurts me.
How do you feel about the police action to the protesters?
There's a good and a bad to both protesters, and there's a good and a bad to police. And I just wish both sides would just stop. Like, I understand what they're fighting for, and I appreciate what everybody's fighting for, but this is not what we're supposed to be like. We're supposed to be fighting together, not against each other. This is not the Hong Kong that I want to be in.
Meanwhile, she's got like a little blankie in her hand, and I mean, she just seems to me to be indicative of precisely the kind of coddled millennial who seems to think that the world is all about the stuff that her parents told her in a bubble she was protected from forever, and her life would be good, and she'd be able to have a happy time and wear a little yellow sundress and enjoy her life. And I hate to break it to you, but life is not like that. Not in Hong Kong, not in Johannesburg, not in any city in the world. It isn't. It is an artificial thing. If you are happy, content, satisfied, not hungry, you have disposable income, you are in an extraordinarily privileged place, because human history is full of mean, nasty, ugly and depraved things.
Well, if this isn't a wake-up call, then I don't know what is.
You're not going to play the rest of it.
Well, do you want to hear the last couple of
seconds? No, you got to.
Oh, you were quoting.
Really, I don't. I would rather go back to South Africa. This is what I'm going to be living with for the next few years.
Yeah, you had to include that part.
It's unacceptable.
I'd rather
go back to South Africa if they're going to live like this for the next few years. This is unacceptable.
Random point. If you squint and look at her, don't you think she looks like Reva Steenkamp?
Yeah.
Mm.
So, look, I mean, apart from the fact that she's an entitled millennial and that this is how a lot of young entitled millennials all over the world talk, because especially privileged white young millennials, I hate to talk identity politics, but it's true. They go, I deserve so much better than what I've got, which you don't. I mean, besides that, is she really that? I didn't think she's that annoying. She's just an extremely sensitive person who's hasn't been told the truth while she was growing up. Is that why she irritates us?
No, funnily enough, I was more like entertained than annoyed.
If you look at social media, people are tearing into her.
Yeah, I just saw a lot of people call her entitled, a lot of people call her ignorant.
Well, the main crux is that she's only thinking about herself. She's not showing any interest or understanding of the protesters. She says I understand, but she actually doesn't.
There's a good and bad.
So she's saying there's a good and a bad in the police as well. I mean, what she said really didn't really make sense.
Well, the problem is, like, everybody jams microphones in front of people who really don't know anything these days, and they expect them to say something sensible. And then when they don't, we all get cross that they didn't say something sensible. You can't go and interview someone in the street, especially if they're running around with a yellow blankie and they're in tears, and ask them what they think. You can ask them what they feel, and you're going to get something meaningless. But you can ask them what they think, and you're always going to be disappointed.
Well, also, on top of that, though, just before this interview, she was the one kneeling in front of the police during the riot.
So that drew attention to the journalists. I think when journalists interview a random person on the street, as long as you don't take it as this is an expert point of view, it's just let's hear what an average person thinks.
An annoying.
and it's also from an entertainment point of view.
Yeah,
that's the way I see it. But it was embarrassing, like a complete lack of understanding of other people and what is going on, and an understanding of the bigger picture. It's like saying I got so annoyed with the picture of Steve Biko's dead body back in 1977. You know, that photo was annoying. It's just almost the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the people who are commenting are people who we don't know what this girl's situation is, and this is what people always do. They jump to a conclusion. But the fact is, and I did it too, and we all do it, when we see someone, we immediately have to stereotype them.
But one positive. With all the misogyny and the sexism and the aggressive tone towards women on social media recently, at least this woman hasn't been a target of that. Like, I haven't seen any overly aggressive misogynist language, unless I've just missed it. I mean, that's a positive side to this all. Am I grasping at straws there?
I'm sure if you dug deep enough, you'd find a couple of horrible things that have been said. But anyway, it's such an interesting story,
I'm going to watch it again later today.
You really liked it, huh?
It's like the Johnny Clegg crossing video. My wife and I are still watching that. Are we going to carry on watching this woman for the next couple of weeks?
All right.
She's going to be our thing.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, stuff in the news. Let's talk about a few stories that you may be interested in this morning. There's a guy who draws in his sleep, but he has no artistic talent when he's awake.
But do you think this is true?
Well, they've tested it.
Oh, they've actually officially tested it.
Do you want to hear the story? See, I've got the story for you. Listen to this.
So his name is Lee Hadwin, and really has no artistic ability at all when he's awake. But when he's asleep, he's now like a proper sleep artist. He's now drawn celebrity portraits. He's drawn these old school classical nudes. He's just also drawn like random abstract things, and they actually sell for thousands of dollars.
Where is he? I say he's in America.
He's in the US. He's 44 years old, and it all began when he was 4 years old, actually, and he's used to scribble on the walls and the floors of his bedroom when he had fallen asleep. And that was the main thing that started to concern his parents. Like, what is exactly going on? Sometimes he would also walk while he was asleep, and he'd continue on drawing on the staircase as he was walking down the stairs in his childhood home. So his parents then took him to doctors, and they spent years trying to understand what was going on, and it was just as simple as that. His mind is in a sleeping state, but his body is in a waking state when he's asleep. So they really basically explained it's an extension of sleepwalk.
And his actual art is good quality art?
It really is. His first one that sold for a lot of money was when he was 15 years old, and he was sketching three different portraits of Marilyn Monroe.
God, wow, that's
amazing. So you think maybe he's a reincarnation of somebody?
I think this is, I don't know.
That's a little bit of a stretch. And reincarnation.
Yeah, but the story is already at a stretch. So, you know, I'm just trying to think, how is this possible? How did this happen?
But a reincarnation, oh yeah.
No, I'm just thinking, like, there's got to be some kind of an explanation.
I think this is also exhausting. Like, after a long day, you'd want to sleep.
But also, the thing is, as well, is that he could have this condition and write real crap.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he's actually, drawing, his stuff could be, like, really bad, like John Lennon's art. But he's actually drawing good stuff, so that makes it even more weird.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying.
No, he's drawing amazing stuff.
I'm thinking, since he was 4 years old, I'm thinking he's been going to art classes and he's been coached and he's been developed. I think he's been developing his art over these years. I don't think, you know what I'm saying.
It's just a natural thing. Yeah, maybe he has been consciously. I think while he's awake.
I think so.
Trying to make it.
He must have.
Look, he's been examined by sleep experts from Scotland to Japan, and no one has been able to give sound explanation of why this is the case.
And tell me, does he have a normal relationship? Is he married?
Well, don't know about that. But he does wake up on average about 2 or 3 times in one single night. That's why I just think this is exhausting.
And how long is he drawing for in the middle of the night? Does it say?
We don't have that information either. But, you know, his highest piece that has sold right now has been for $125,000.
Yeah, what's his name again?
That's a pretty penny. Lee Hadwin.
You see, I just got to, call me a cynic, but I think there's more to the story that is not being exposed.
You know what? You're a cynic.
Yeah, of course.
You're a big cynic.
It's just the story doesn't really add up.
He does say in conclusion, though, that his life changed overnight.
That's not overnight. They've been developing it. He's like the Serena Williams of dream art. I mean, you know, come on. He's been developed.
Well, even if that's the case, it's a new type of career.
Huh?
It's hilarious.
Dream art.
All right, here's whatever. A much more important thing.
Sure.
We have all had a situation where you meet someone at the airport.
To pick them up.
No. Maybe you're in transit, they're in transit, maybe you're both meeting in a foreign city.
Oh.
And you want to get intimate with them, but there's no time because their flight is in 2 hours.
Okay.
Your flight's in an hour.
You want
hour.
A quick shochel, okay?
Right, you want a quick shochel. Now, you can't do that in an airport, right?
Well, you're going to the bathroom.
Well, you can't, because it's usually the male bathroom, the female bathroom. You can't have a man going to the women's bathroom, women going to the man's
bathroom.
You're
going to the handicapped.
You can't do that in an
airport.
Because
there's more space in the handicapped.
And sometimes you could get arrested. Germany is setting up sex booths in their airport. Now, isn't that interesting?
But like all over the Germany or just one particular airport?
See, so I can tell you.
They're looking at one airport in particular right now. There's
You got to start small. This is a pilot, the pilot project.
I see what you're doing there.
Yeah.
Airport pilot. I see what you're doing there.
Actually, I wasn't doing that.
I actually think this
I interrupted you. Sorry.
I actually think this is a great idea.
Interrupted him interrupting.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry.
Unnecessary.
Carry on, y'all.
This is why people get annoyed with you, Damon.
Sorry. Carry on.
Thank you. I actually think this is a great idea because the mayor's behind it, the whole city's behind it, because they're saying they want to improve the safety of the city's sex workers. Uh-huh. So they will be installing these booths where prostitutes can meet clients in the airport site, and it's just going to be convenient for everyone everyone involved. It's Stephen von Dassel, the mayor who represents the Green Party in Berlin, and they say they're attempting to combat prostitution and by making sure that everything is as safe as possible. So they say that residents and businesses have been calling for a ban on street prostitution for many years.
Oh.
So it's street prostitution that they have an issue with. So now they're proposing a restriction on street prostitution in the district by making more of these sex work comfortable or accommodating centers or spaces. Okay. So this is why they're going to have these booths to also control sex work in the city.
Okay, the story is slightly confusing
mm-hmm.
because are these booths for strangers who meet or is it booths specifically
for prostitutes? Yes. So it will be happening in Berlin's former Tempelhof airport. That will now be having this. I mean, if not, why not?
This is important because Tempelhof is no longer an airport.
Mm.
I was there last year
and?
Because they've turned the old runways. Tempelhof used to be the main Berlin airport during the Third Reich. Right? So it's where the Luftwaffe would come and go.
Aye.
So what they did,
there'll be more people coming and going. After
1960 something, when they did the Berlin airlift, shut down Tempelhof Airport in the 90s. And stopped using it as an airport. Mm-hmm. Now it's a place where people walk their dogs and people go to run and they throw the frisbee and on the runway.
And then where's the real airport?
Well, no, there's still airport buildings. The real Berlin airport is outside of town, a couple of kilometers
outside. Oh, and what do they call that airport?
I can't remember.
Well, then this is a little confusing. How will there be sex work and then also my seven-year-old... son is throwing frisbees.
So they're not going to have the sex workers running around where the people are throwing frisbees and walking their dogs. There's a building, the old airport building, which is largely unused. They use it for expos and for that kind of thing. So they'll probably dedicate a small part of the Tempelhof Airport to sex workers.
I'm so confused. So in other words, there aren't prostitutes at a normal airport.
No. You see, when you said Tempelhof, the whole story changed in my head.
Yeah, the story...
it didn't make
sense.
Who
wrote that story? I don't know.
Well, this is also more confusing then if the space is used for expos. You know, you have...
Yeah.
Bill, who's there on a business conference, and then there'll also be John, who's there for
trust me, Bill on a business conference is probably the first target for the prostitutes, and he's looking for them. So,
is that, you know, I've never been to Germany, and yes, they might be speaking about this so openly. How is the stigma around prostitution or sex work in that area? Because
the Germans are very open-minded, huh? They really are. They don't have a problem with this. Germans, by the way, they also don't have issues around nudity. I mean, the Germans just love getting naked. You don't have to persuade a German to take their clothes off.
So you can casually leave the house to go and buy milk, and you can casually leave the house to go and buy
sex
or pay
from
for
a prostitute. Sure.
And that's seen as equal, and no one blinks an eye.
The Germans love it. They love it. Germans very open-minded about sex. Very. It's a big thing.
Very open-minded.
Very. They love them some sex.
Damon, is this excited you more ways than one? Anyway, talking about some creepy sex stories, let's have a bit of a Jeffrey Epstein update.
Yes,
oy, shame.
What a story.
Would you? You know what I thought to myself the moment he passed on? He died.
Well, he committed suicide.
Imagine the rabbi who's officiating his funeral. Because when you officiate a funeral, you've got to say good things about the person.
Yeah.
So imagine you're the rabbi who's got to talk about the late Jeffrey. What do you do?
Yeah. Well, he had sex with many underage women. That's what you could say.
You just have to go back to those basic cliches. There's never a dull moment with Jeff around.
We can judge Jeffrey. We can judge him.
But first take
but let's look at the
out
good
of
he
your
did.
Own eye before you take it out of...
He used to take his... He used to visit his mother, Zelda, at the old age home every Sunday afternoon. Yeah, let's not focus on the negative.
It's going to be a tough job.
Well, yeah, he must have been buried straight away.
You think? Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But this is... the real issue isn't so much how Jeffrey will be eulogized. The real issue is, like, this guy died under very suspicious circumstances.
Well,
so what's happened? Eh. What's happened to the people at the prison?
Well, we officially have a statement now from the prison.
Took them long enough.
I mean, yeah,
right.
You better. They've just stated that there were serious irregularities at the New York prison.
No.
And that they were appalled and angry to learn of the facility's failure to adequately secure this prisoner.
Sure. Yeah, I know. It is bizarre.
Then there were the two employees who were actually on duty the night Jeffrey Epstein died.
And
they've now been placed on administrative leave until further.
And they haven't been quoted as to their explanation.
No.
What went wrong? Did they fall asleep?
No. They haven't spoken out. They haven't been allowed to speak out.
But the thing is, Epstein wasn't on official suicide watch.
No.
So can you really blame those two people? Because it's whoever made that decision to take him off suicide watch.
Mm. We now also know their names, though. The two wardens who were on duty that
night. Bill and
Hillary.
Imagine if they were the wardens. That could actually solve the case.
Well, Gareth is convinced he saw Hillary with a moustache on walk into the prison that night.
Someone posted a picture of
she didn't wax that week.
Yeah, no, Hillary. Bill and Hillary were the wardens.
She needed some level of disguise. James Petrucci and Lamine Ndiaye. I'm going to butcher that.
Ndiaye.
It's on. I don't know. Lamine and James were on duty that night, and they've now been placed on administrative leave. Yeah. I say that's a very nice way to put it.
Bill and Hillary.
I just feel bad for the one of the two employees on duty that night who was actually not even meant to be working there, and they were filling in for someone.
No, they were looking for overtime, looking to earn more money. Yeah. That's what happens. Or, let's do an extra shift.
Or if I let my, you know, conspiracy theory part of my mind run away with me, what an apt time for you to casually fill in for someone. Where do you come from all of a sudden?
You mean that you decided placed there? Mm. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, if Epstein died of blood loss, like a stab or whatever, then that opens the door more to that kind of wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he hung himself.
Hanged. Himself.
What did I say?
Hung.
Oi, he was well hung. The fact that he hanged himself, you know, it lends itself more to self-infliction, no conspiracy, etc.
By the way, this is not the end of the story for the people who have been.
No, they carry on with the investigation.
Correct.
Because they're still going to go after people that maybe conspired with Epstein. Because you can't do that. If Epstein is guilty of what he did, you can't do that alone.
No.
You need help.
Right. And he did need help. But he just didn't need Bill and Hillary to be his wardens that night.
Look, Damon, this is what I said on, I think, Monday. I believe we'll now see the building where all of the evidence was placed just burn up the next couple of days.
Fire.
Or someone who's transporting it in a car.
The fire engine will be
fall into the Hudson River.
Look, this time of the year, the air in New York, I think, is quite dry. Mm-hmm. And that could lend itself to like a natural fire. Or maybe I'm just making that up.
Oh, no.
And maybe
the
W.H. Clinton fire engine will just not be operating tonight. It's so exciting. This whole Epstein thing is so exciting.
But when I first heard the story, I thought, what? I'm imagining. It's so bizarre.
It's very bizarre.
Well, we should have been able to see that it's going down a different path a couple of weeks ago when there was that first
There were marks on his neck.
Where he had to go to hospital because he had tried to commit suicide earlier.
And so why they didn't keep him on suicide watch is just so incompetent.
It's completely bizarre.
All right. Let's move on.
Sure.
The stories of South Africa's freedom fighters are well known. The stories of the remarkable women who played an important role in the struggle against apartheid, however, sadly, often remain untold. This is just because history is his story, as the lesbians will tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hardly ever her story, and this is a problem. Women's stories are not told in the way that men's are, and they're starting to be told in the way that men's stories are. It is Women's Month, and we thought we would focus on something that ENCA are doing, which I think is very laudable. They are paying tribute to some of the incredible women who have fought for the freedom that we all share today in a series of stories about struggle, perseverance, and survival, which is called Women of the Liberation. Now, to talk more about this, the team behind us that will join us this morning include Michelle Craig, who's the ENCA anchor. You've probably seen her doing the news. Manale Di Mataboge Mashitla, who is a senior researcher, and Helene Nivenice, who is a senior producer for Special Projects. And we know Helene because she, for a long time, used to also produce Jeremy Mags' show.
Oh.
Yes, Mags on Media. And Women of the Liberation starts on Sunday evening, 8:30 p.m. in the month of August on ENCA. Each episode features a unique story from each woman's perspectives. The series is produced by Helene Nivenice and Manaledi, and it is hosted by ENCA's female anchors. So we're going to find out a little bit about these stories. The first episode is already aired on the 4th of August, and in that first episode, Michelle visited the home of Nomonde and Dorothy Kalata in Craddock. They are the wife and daughter of murdered anti-apartheid activist Fort Kalata. I actually remember reading a book about
the Craddock Four.
Yeah. But I mean, the Kalatas are interesting because they not only were involved in, first of all, the 34th anniversary, as Damon rightly points out, of the brutal killings of the Craddock Four, but also the events that changed their lives forever after that, because, of course, they had a relationship with... let me just go through the biography and help you here. The mother of SABC8 journalist Lucanio Kalata, who's someone whose book I read probably about 2 years ago.
Oh.
And that's why I was making the connection with the SABC in my head as well. But ladies, well done, first of all, on telling some of these stories, which I think are often neglected and ignored. And if we're going to talk about issues of national significance and importance, we may as well focus on those issues which don't get the attention that they probably deserve. And for various reasons, those things happen. A lot of people pay lip service to Women's Month, but this is actually excellent because you give, I suppose, those spirits of these great women some kind of honor, some kind of rest, some ability for the rest of us to reflect on the things that they did during their lives. It's a terrific idea. Whose idea was this at the very outset?
I'm going to give credit to Manaledi on this one.
Manaledi, well done.
Thank you, Gareth, and good morning. Thanks for having us.
Sure, absolutely.
So, one evening in April, I think, I was at my home and already thinking ahead. And then I thought, we cover these women's stories every August during Women's Month. And we pretty much focus on the same things every year. And I started wondering, at that time, I think I was cooking and helping with homework, and then I've got a three-year-old. So I was doing all of this sort of thing. And I was like, but how did they cope? Because they were freedom fighters. Some of them were being trained as soldiers in exile. They also had to be mothers and wives at the same time. And they also had extended families, like their mothers.
Right. Yeah,
that they had to think of. So at that time, I sent a WhatsApp message to my line manager saying, I've got an idea. I think we should do this, but we must do it differently. We must try to get a mother and a daughter to see how that has also affected the daughter's upbringing in any way. But also these women, how do they cope with this? And his response was like, I like the idea, go ahead, but put it on paper. And for a long time, you know, you get busy with this and this and that, and it was election
time. It wasn't a priority.
Yeah, so. It wasn't really. Yeah, town hall meetings were. And I did it was on paper.
I remember watching poor Dan Moyane trying to get people to shut up while, I think it was the UDM who came in and ruined, like, what was otherwise a very civilized meeting. So,
yeah.
So you were obviously involved in all of that stuff, and that means this gets put on the back burner.
Yeah. But then, in between, I tried to do research on different women to see who we can choose. And we ended up with a long list of about 30 or something, and even that list was just not enough.
Right.
Because we kept on adding and adding and adding. And we realized that there are too many untold stories, and we cannot tell everyone's story.
Sure.
And it was a very difficult choice to make.
So you eventually could do what, four or five?
Five. Mm-hmm. Five, because we've got 5 weeks in August. but also depending on other people's availability, because some people are ambassadors, some don't live here anymore, they work in other countries. So availability also, yeah, guided us a lot. Yeah.
All right, so you started with the Kalatas, and I suppose that's a good place for us to start. First of all, Dorothy was the wife, is that right?
No, Dorothy's
the daughter.
The first daughter.
Nomonde is the wife.
Nomonde is the wife.
Okay. And tell me about the circumstances they're in now. What kinds of lives do these women have now, and what sort of memories of their father and the struggle do they have? And then what are the particular challenges you wanted to focus on?
Yeah. So on the face of it, they're living a fairly good life, you know. They live in a, I would say, modern township, clean. It appears safe. Mm-hmm. At least when we walked in, there's no fence. You know, you just walk through to the door. Mm-hmm. Like, all the houses are like, yeah, pretty familiar houses. But the trauma is still with them. And I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. The minute they start telling the story, you can see from the face that things just change. Mm. And I think it's the pain that they're going to live with for the rest of their lives. I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
We always pay attention to the main, you know, protagonist in these stories. And in that case, it was their father and husband who was murdered. But we don't really go to pick up the pieces very often and to see what the ruins are that the rest of the family is left in. And it's usually the mom who has to pick up those pieces and keep going, right?
Indeed. I mean, I think we romanticize in many ways the stories of people who survived apartheid. You know, we think about these icons, you know, the Craddock Four. What their torture and murder meant was a turning point in South Africa. That was when we saw the first partial state of emergency being effected. Mm. So we think of it as, oh, their great sacrifice for democracy, you know. But we don't, that's what we see on paper, but we don't really go into what that sacrifice really meant. Nomonde Kalata was a 26-year-old mother of two. She was pregnant with her third child. She said goodbye to her husband on that Thursday morning, thinking that she would see him that night.
Yeah.
She had a doctor's appointment that day for her pregnancy. He was looking forward to that baby. You know, that night, he doesn't come home. They're thinking, you know, maybe he is hiding out somewhere. Possibly he's been smuggled out of the country because there was so much focus on the Craddock Four at the time.
And just by the way, did she even know about a lot of the detail around what he was doing?
She did. Mm-hmm. She did.
Because some of these wives were in the dark
she
about what their husbands
involved.
Were. You know?
No, she yes, did know, and she was also involved. And, she, you know, they supported each other in that because they wanted to see change in Craddock. Fort Kalata also, in Lukanya's book, actually, he talks about...
My father died for this, is what the book is.
It's sort of an ironic title, you know, because... Mm.
Because he's very pissed off with
this is what my father died for. This
and
is
course,
the great
with his
sacrifice.
Involvement in the SABC 8, he's got reasons to be bitter.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, they thought he might have been smuggled out of the country even, and for a month after that, this young family is waiting for their father to come home. And hoping for that entire time. And when Nomonde is finally told the news of her husband's body being found, he'd been tortured, very clearly tortured. She didn't see his body. That's another issue around closure, you know. She was advised not to see his body because of the state it was in. Dogs had been set on his body. There were clumps of hair missing from his skull. Fingers had been removed. Mm. So, you know, you're looking at us in shock, and that's the response that I think is warranted. We don't know, really, the sacrifice of these families.
Did she not have a chance to, during that very, I mean, it was limited in its scope and in its time, but during the TRC, wasn't this part of what was brought up? I mean, we know that some other people had their opportunity to hear the story, to get the full picture, to have some closure. She didn't have that?
She did.
She did.
She did. She appeared before the TRC. She told her story. I mean,
exactly
there were two.
One of the things that she's unhappy about to this day.
Oh, really?
That she went, told her story with the other widows. But justice has never been served. No one has ever been held accountable for this. So there have been two inquests that were held already, one during apartheid, one after, and now the NPA is promising to reopen some cases, including this one, but no one has ever been held accountable. So you always get the verdict that says, yes, the state is the one that was behind this. But who in the state? I mean, we had people who appeared before the TRC, policemen who said, I issued an instruction, I got an instruction from above, but I made, the other one said, I gave a black policeman to stab them, instructions to stab them. But what was your role in that? And what happens? Why are you not prosecuted?
Also, like,
where are those black policemen that were told to do things, maybe taking orders, but they did it anyway?
But they were killed.
Why no name, you know?
Also, I mean, the TRC testimony of those policemen are on the YouTube for anybody to see. You've got people sitting there admitting to their role in this.
I know, and then they've never had to account for
it. And nothing has happened.
But I think to some degree that was what the TRC was about, is let's all lay it out on the table. And there were some, you know, there were lots of tears, and I remember the anguish. I was a little kid at the time when I saw these things, and I thought, wow, this is almost like what we need to do more consistently as a nation. It's a national therapy session. It just never went anywhere, and for some people it's left a much more gaping and ugly wound in their own histories. So how do you decide on the other women and how to tell their stories? And Helene, when it comes to producing something like this, how do you put that together? Because there's a lot of material. You've got to squeeze it in.
It really takes a village. I think what we're really thankful about, I mean, you're in the media industry, you know, we're quite cheap and dirty when it comes to things a lot of the time. We're not always given the resources.
By the way, everybody thinks that a TV channel always has tons and tons of money. You don't. So you guys probably had to hop in your own cars. Drive
fart over cameras.
Yeah.
Listen, that struggle really is real.
Yeah.
But we managed to get buy-in from management at ENCA, which we're very thankful for. And, I mean, this is dream team for us to be able to work to have a senior researcher and a producer and amazing female anchors and an amazing crew of cameramen and interns who also got to be part of this. Firstly, I think it's a really great learning opportunity for young people in the industry, which I think should happen more. But I mean, yeah, it's blood, sweat, and tears. Firstly, just to try and tie the interviews down, a lot of these women are still extremely active. We've lost many of them, which was also part of the reason we wanted to do the series now, because I really feel we're starting to lose that generation of women who can tell those stories.
Yeah.
So it really is the time to do it. And then I always say the hard work really only happens after the interview is done, because then you have to sit in the edit and craft the end product, which is almost, I would say, the most important part, because like with the Kalatas, we weren't sleeping through this process because you want to do it justice. Because it's such an incredibly powerful and personal story to them.
Yeah. Have you heard feedback from them since it was aired?
Yes.
Yeah, actually, so Lucanio called all of us on the night that it premiered.
Every time after we air a series, we get feedback from them. We've done two already with the Shoppers last Sunday.
Yeah, the Shoppers. And you also, let me just cover the others. There's Judy Ann Seidman, who's a former MK member, Dr. Navi Pile, and Lindiwe Zulu.
Yes. Mm.
Now, Lindiwe Zulu, I remember, came in here and I spoke to her about 2 or 3 years ago when she was still Minister of Small Business. And she told us the story about, you know, having been essentially a fighter in Angola and what she had to put up with there. And there are probably stories she wouldn't tell.
Yeah,
well,
we paired her
with her two daughters, her two eldest daughters, who she had to leave.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a 16-year-old mother, I think
it was. She was 16 when she had her first child. By 19, she had two. And she had to leave them behind with her grandmother in Swaziland to exile.
And so
for 14 years, she didn't see them.
Yeah, and so the interesting part is, like we say, that the things we don't talk about the female experience in all of this is, what does it take to leave your children? And also, what does it mean for two young girl children to be left behind? So we had a very raw discussion. I felt she was very honest. So this one is still coming up. It's only airing at the end of the series. But afterwards, the daughters actually came to us on the day that we shot and said to us, you know, we haven't spoken about this as a family. We haven't spoken about us feeling abandoned.
Man, that must be difficult.
So one of the most difficult things to do was to call people and say, we want to come to your house. We want to talk about things that you hardly talk about. And you had to be direct and say, I know this much. I know this. And I want you to speak to the nation about it. It's not an easy thing, because for most of them, yes, they would like their story to be known, but it's painful.
Mm.
They're opening up wounds.
Sure.
Yeah, so...
But when you're recording these shows, how do you keep it together? I mean, I'm almost falling apart.
We don't. The Galata interview especially, I think, was incredibly hard, but we knew it would be.
Did you have to stop and start a lot?
No, we actually prefer not to do that. And for me, as the anchor of the show, or even on my show every day, you know, we have these difficult stories. We have stories of rape. We have all kinds of incredibly difficult and emotional stories. And I think I pretty much managed to keep it together. You know, there have been moments. I remember a particular court case involving a child being murdered, sort of over 2 years, being tortured and eventually dying by his stepfather. That was the one time I remember struggling to keep it together on air. But for this story around the Galatas and sitting in their living room and hearing the story from Nomonde, yeah, I know. Well, there was no way.
Listen to this to give you a taste of the kind of thing that we're talking about.
For Galata's death was the start of a long journey for Nomonde. Reeling from the death of her husband while pregnant with her third child, the young mother still endured constant harassment from the apartheid state. She testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but even to this day, doesn't have any real closure. No one has been held accountable for the torture and murder of the Craddock Four. These incredibly traumatic events help shape each member of the family in very different ways.
Wow, I mean, it's not as if there's any lack of material, and this is the sad thing, right? As you said, you had to now whittle it down to the five that you could cover. But there are so many untold stories like this in South Africa. There's an element of what you're doing, though, that is archiving our history, which is hugely important, because these people are often not going to be in a position to record their own story.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if they were a celebrity who'd written a hit song, someone would be rushing to them to give them a book deal or to interview them for television. But here we have real people going through real trauma for decades, not even, you know, for a short period. Mm-hmm. And we don't get to the heart of their story very often.
You know, one of the tiny examples that I can give, when I was reading through the TRC files, I found that Nomonde mentioned that at the time that a priest, a reverend that was tasked with breaking the news to the family, mentioned that, in fact, he mentioned it in prayer. I guess he also didn't know how to break the news. So they started praying, and in the middle of that prayer, the reverend was like, and we thank you, God, that the bodies of Fort Galata and Matthew Konu have been found. That's how the news were broken. And Lukanyo, being a three-year-old at the time, started like reacting physically, like, you know.
He started throwing up.
Throwing up at that time. And Dorothy was nine. Dorothy started singing a hymn. So it's like a house full of, and it's tense, you know. She's been fetched from church, and she knew at that time when she was fetched that something could have happened, because they've been looking for the father. So when I got to the part about her singing and just not stopping, continuing to sing and sing and sing, I said, this is the story that we haven't heard a lot about. We must pose this question. And we posed the question. And she, for the first time ever, spoke about why she sang a hymn. She sang until everyone in the room could join them and cry. Because no one was crying. It was just tense.
This is a nine-year-old.
It's a nine-year-old. So for a nine-year-old to react like that, you can see trauma already playing itself out there. So we asked her about it. She explained what she was feeling at the time, why she was singing, because singing was her way of expressing her emotions. Singing was a way that she would alert the neighbors when the police came to the house to raid the house, to get her father and whatever. She would just go out on the stoop and start singing. That the neighbors then knew that, oh, they have arrived, and people would come out of their houses and whatever. So to her, singing was just a
coping mechanism.
Of doing it. And she cried. I mean, everyone ended up crying because she now had to go back to that moment and say, yes, I sang because it was the only way I knew how.
Just, you know, we don't know these things until, yeah, thankfully you tell us them. And was it easy to research this stuff? Is there a lot of information out there, or is there...
There's a lot of information. Some information is a little bit distorted, but in researching this, I also had to speak to the people first, yeah, that I've come across this and this.
And I think Tukanyo's book also helped a lot.
Yes, and which one is factual, and they would correct me or no, this one, here's the fact, here's what. But there's a lot of information that is like sugar-coated in a way. So when you drill deep into it, then you get the facts. But I think by doing this series, we have somehow documented what I would call oral history, mm, that will stay for a very long time. And I think these untold stories, if we were to get an opportunity, maybe with other media houses, they can also try to do these things.
Do more of them, yeah.
You know, yes. Then we shouldn't just wait for Women's Month or for Freedom Month to tell the, yeah, stories, because we can tell them throughout.
How do we feel about... This constant lip service that is paid to women in this country, particularly women of a certain generation, where we see politicians saying the same old stuff every year in August, and they trot out that 16 days of activism in December, and they say, well, they always relate it to men in some way. And I think that this is the stuff that South African women are just tired of. Am I right?
Absolutely.
I was speaking to our colleague Marcel Gordon, who did the interview with Judge Navi Pillay in the series. And we were speaking about it yesterday. So a big theme that's come out in a lot of the stories, except for in the Galata story, possibly because we just didn't get to that part of the story, but there's a very big theme of rape running through many, many, many of these stories.
Yeah.
And we were talking, I was speaking to Marcel yesterday saying, I remember working on a documentary about South Africa as the Republic of Rape straight after the gang rape and murder of teenager Anine Boysen.
I remember that. Hideous
in
story.
2015 or 16. And there were silent protests and there were vigils and everybody spoke about it. We were all outraged. And then...
She gets put away.
Yeah. But also the fact that rape was taken off the table at the TRC. Judge Navi Pillay was the one at the Rwanda tribunal who put rape on the table as an act of war. Before that, it was... And that's a couple of... That's 25 years ago. Not even.
Please. Not even. Yeah, 90s. The hardest part about all of this, I suppose, is that we hold up a mirror to ourselves as South Africa as well. There's obviously a huge amount of responsibility and blame to be laid at the door of the apartheid government. But most of those people are now dead and gone. The harder part is to realize that this is our inheritance.
Yeah. So Gareth, in this series, towards the end of the interview, we asked the questions about now,
yeah,
about where we are now. Because we want these women to be able to say, when I was fighting, when I went to exile, this was the outcome I was hoping for. Yes, I think we have done 20% of that or 30% of that.
I don't want you to spoil the forthcoming episodes, but,
yeah,
but I would imagine that for many of these women, it was a sacrifice that was worthless to them, or at least that it wasn't worth what they've ended
up
with.
Well, and tying into Lucano's book, my father died for this. I left my children for this. Yeah. I suffered for what?
In fact, Dorothy said in the interview, her father wanted to study law. And she was like, I keep wondering what would have happened if my father could have left this politics things and just studied law. Maybe he could have lived a better life. Maybe he would still be here. You know, so they asking themselves too many questions. Did we really suffer for this?
Yeah, and you talk about archiving our history, that this is part of that kind of exercise. But I think it's also part of educating not only younger South Africans, people our age, who really have no idea what the price we paid for this democracy that we have.
I knew the names, and I knew about the Craddock Four. I knew Matthew Goniwe because he was very much in the news when I started to become aware of these things. But I had no idea about any of this stuff.
And you're more informed than most.
Mm.
Well, let's hope that this will change now. This is the point of work like what you guys have done. And I'm very glad that you've alerted us to it here, because, you know, there could be many more people who didn't know this was on ENCA on Sunday, and who might want to go and watch the other episodes, which are now on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go and see, if you missed the episode that we're talking about on the 4th, then you can go and see it now on YouTube. It's great work. Well done.
But are we missing the elephant in the room?
What's that?
What's the koch between ENCA and the Newsroom Africa? What's the vibe? Or do you guys feel threatened? What's the story?
Who are those?
In the
All right. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Was that diplomatic enough?
No answer.
Got to move on to this because we're out of time.
They just giggled uncomfortably.
Michelle Manaledi and Hillian, thank you so much for sharing your time with us this morning, and good luck with the rest of the show. I'm sure it's going to do extremely well, and if it changes the opinion and the lack of information, the ignorance of so many of us, then that would be a very good thing.
Thanks for having us.
Congrats. And listen to these brave women who've participated in this and who actually said, yes, you can come into my house and be a part of my life, and I can tell you my most heart-wrenching, ugly, nasty, difficult and complex, painful story, then maybe we can do something for someone else. That's incredible.
But I'm sure it was also cathartic for them.
Ah, yeah.
You know?
I mean, some of them have never been listened to.
Exactly.
Look, mm-hmm. I think it starts the process, but I think there's a lot of work and a lot of conversations to be had.
Oh, well. That's mm-hmm. understatement.
And yeah. I really hope we get to do more of these.
Yes, indeed. You can watch Women of the Liberation. It's on Sunday evenings at 8:30 p.m. during the month of August on ENCA. Each episode features a unique story from each woman's perspectives, and sometimes there are more than one woman in each episode. Hosted by ENCA's female anchors, and the episodes will run for the whole of this month. Make sure that you pay attention and you go and watch, and it might just give you some inspiration too, because it's not all just ugly and sad stories and difficulty, but it's also very inspiring to see what some of these women have gone through and how they've survived some of the things that most of us will never ever understand or deal with during our lives. It is just before 8 o'clock. Damon, thanks for the visit.
Ah, thank you.
Ladies, thank you so much for coming to share some time with us today. And we will see you tomorrow, bright and early, at 6 o'clock.
This is CliffCentral.com.